Back in 1992, Sophie B. Hawkins first hit the top 10 with Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover, and then the album Tongues and Tales helped her earn a Grammy nomination for Best New Artist in 1993. And since then, Sophie has been busy releasing a total of 4 studio albums. The 5th one's going to be released this October. We're going to talk about that and so much more right now as we are joined via Skype with Miss Sophie B. Hawkins. How you doing?
I'm doing so well. I'm so happy about this album. I can't even tell you.
Yeah, The Crossing. So mid-October here, that's coming out. Tell us all about the album, how excited you are about that.
Well, I'm really excited because, first of all, every album is exciting, but this one in particular feels like my first album. I got down, like, after all, you know, there's so many changes in life, you know, we all go through these passages, which is, I guess, why the album's called The Crossing. I came to this point of, you know, having been through such major success, such major failure, and then back up to success, back down to failure, and riding these incredible waves, like a real sailor, you know, and really always sticking to my art, always keeping on going, whether there's 100,000 people in Madison Square Garden or one person in some little town in, you know, Bath, Maine. I just keep doing the best shows I can possibly do and making the best music I can and writing and writing. And then I got to this point where I said, you know, I don't know about the business has changed so much. I don't know if I can ever really get support for an album again. So I started really just being Sophie, the undiscovered nobody, and writing songs really happily, just happily and sadly in every way that you write songs, you know. And I had a baby, and I kept painting a lot. I started writing musicals and doing other things, and I really didn't think this album was ever going to come out. So in a way, it was really special to me, like my very first demos before Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover, before Tongues and Tales, before I became Sophie B. Hawkins, and I was just this unknown songwriter. This album comes from that place of the unknown songwriter, and I love that place the best because it's a whole new beginning for me. So in other words, David, it's like, I don't know how many people will hear it, but I know the right people will hear it. And I have a kind of a general knowing about this album that it's going to find its right place and its right listeners and take me where I need to go. And it's incredible the trust that I had making it and the trust that I have now that I finally have a release date.
Well, yeah, and you talked about, you know, how personal and vulnerable this album is, and I understand that you had these songs written for quite a while, and you didn't think anybody would ever hear them, like you kind of mentioned. How long did you have these tracks kind of, you know, in the vault, and, you know, and what made you decide to go for it and release them?
Well, and actually, they weren't, I mean, some of them I wrote even just 6 months ago. The album now has 17 songs on it, used to have 20. So I do keep adding new songs, so none of the songs are really that old. No songs are more than 3 years old. So it's not like that old. Like when I talk in terms of time, like I've written, you know, 2 musicals and whatever in the last year. So to me, time goes very fast. But so they weren't in that vault that long, but a lot has happened in the last 3 years. You know, like I said, my father died. I had a child. All these new career things started happening. I started seeing myself in a whole other way, possibly. So, and the reason why I didn't let them out was because there was no label to support it, and I had done independently, released 2 albums independently, and I couldn't do it anymore. You know, the physical work, the financial work, all of it, I just thought I can't really get anywhere that way. I really do need support. And I was willing to wait for where the support was coming from, and that's why I'm really glad that I did wait, and it came. You know, without me forcing and saying, I got to get it out, whether I have support or not, I'm just going to do it all myself. That's a great thing to do at a certain point, but I wasn't at that point anymore.
And you talked about becoming a mother for the first time. You know, has that changed your writing much? How has that kind of impacted?
Oh, my God. It's so changed it. But you know what it is? It adds to it. I think it expands it. Like, here's an example. I'm not sure I ever changed that much, but I do keep expanding. And the reason why I say that is because I'm having this opportunity because someone wants to use Big Beautiful Bottom in a commercial, which is one of the very first songs I ever wrote, called Big Beautiful Bottom in My Face, and it's one of my favorite songs, and my fans know it. Okay, so I have to redo it because the demo's long gone. I did it on Reel to Reel, and I have to redo it, and I'm listening to it, trying to redo the vocal exactly like I used to do it, and I was It's like impossible. It was so spontaneous and it was so great in a way. And I'm listening to something I did almost 20 years ago and I think, man, it's almost better than anything I could ever do now. So I don't think I really changed because I really will like jump back and forth in time and I realize I'm the same person and still trying to be the best part of the same person. But I do keep expanding and having a child has made me expand so much more. Emotionally, it's just such a challenge, and it's a thing where you just land. For me, like my child may need me for survival, but I need my child so much more than he needs me, because he's taught me everything that was the big blank in my life, the big question. He's teaching me constantly.
And you talked about the couple
he's
music.
Killing me constantly.
Oh.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. And you talked about you know the couple of musicals you've been working on. I know one of them was with Gigi and Kristen Chenoweth. You know how?
Yes, it's still going.
How has that process been? You know, I'm sure it's different than writing songs. Kind of probably refreshing, I'm assuming.
Yeah, it's challenging in a whole other way because at first I thought I can't write from the point of view of another character, but then I started to do it and I realized it was actually very natural to me. Because you know what, in musicals, the saying is, and it's really true, you have to sing what can't be said. So what's really it's refreshing in one way, but it's very natural in another for me because I write songs from way deep inside me, and I'm always trying to tell the truth about something in my songs. I would say, well, this character is at this place in his life. What does he need to sing that he can't say? What's his inner life? What's he really going through? The song has to represent a transformation. For me, that's how I come about it. Like I go, okay, this father's, he's been drunk all his life. He's at this crossing point in his life. What does he really need to say to the, what does the audience need to know that this that is a big reveal that he couldn't say to the other characters? So in a way, that's kind of natural for me because I'm always looking inside myself saying, what do I really feel? What do I really need to say that's not on the outside? That's coming.
Are you there?
Actress.
Oh, there you
yeah, I'm here. Are you there?
Oh, there you are. I'm here now. Sorry, I broke up.
Oh, I'm so sorry. So, David, I was saying that I do a lot of research. You know, like I'll study the times and I'll study the all the surroundings of what the character would have been like. It's not like I just go at it totally from my imagination. I do a lot of research, and then I approach it as an emotional journey, the writing for the musical, and I'm addicted to it. We have another reading in November in New York, and I'm it's like one of my big passions is this musical.
Very cool. Very good. I can't wait to see it. And then one of the things
oh, man.
Best about you, you know, I respect a lot about you is how many different organizations and you believe in something and you're passionate and you go for it. So I want to give you some props for the Waterkeeper Alliance stuff. I know you've been donating, you know, lots of proceeds from the land, the sea, and the sky to them. What is that organization exactly? Talk about that a little bit.
Oh, the Waterkeeper Alliance. Well, when there was the BP oil rig blew up, and what was that, last April or something? When that blew up, the Waterkeeper Alliance, they're an international organization. They were the first people to get there. In fact, they probably always were there because they are working on every estuary all over the world all the time, testing the water, making sure there's no poisons coming into the water, cleaning off the animals. They're really on the front lines, and they're never noticed because they always have their heads down and working. And, in fact, they work so hard that I would ask them, can you please just send me a picture for the video I'm making for the land and sea and the sky? And they're like, we don't have time. We're saving animals. I mean, we're saving dolphins. We're saving whales. We don't have time to snap a picture and send it to you, you know, via the Internet. So I went down there myself, as you know, to the Gulf, and I'm started picking up oil and shot a video there, which is coming out, and the video is called Sinner Man, and I love this video. It's all about the Gulf. I went down with Gigi and with Richard Grinnell right after the spill. We were actually chased by police. It's in the video as we were picking up oil. So the water keepers are doing what we did in one weekend. They're doing it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, all year round in all the waters across the earth. So they don't get any money from the government. They don't get any money except for people like me who go, oh, you're there. Let me help you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's who they are. If you check them out, I think Robert Kennedy is the head of them, even though they really do not get any government funding, which I think is fine, actually, because you know what? That means they can hold the government accountable. And I got all my information from them, you know, when I was really going, you guys, the government isn't doing anything, and just because it's a Democrat at the head of the White House doesn't mean they're really truly environmentally conscious. And so we have to do something. And that's okay, by the way. I'm not saying that's not okay. I'm saying that. But when that's the case, we have to act. And we have to be aware that the government can't do everything. We must be the stewards of the earth. We must be good citizens. It's our earth. It's not. We can't turn around and go, oh, the government didn't do anything, and they let BP do this, and then they went and gave the drilling rights to Brazil, who's going to be even worse, which is true. We have to act as citizens. We can't point fingers anymore at Democrats and Republicans and all this bull. It's just distracting us, and what we're really doing is not doing anything.
You need to get into politics. I'd vote for you.
You would? That's so funny, but you know what? I love politics, but I realized really recently that I mean, that world is those people. They don't change very much.
You're too honest to be a politician. That's a good point.
That's what I'm saying. I had such, you know, when I started getting so interested and active in the Gulf, I really got excited because I thought, we can really wake up, and there's people like obviously you are, and there's people who are in like radio and the media and internet radio and stuff that really get up, but you can't change that system. We have to change, and that's why we shouldn't fault any group or organization that comes from the ground up and goes and tries to change things. We should really admire them because that's all the change that's going to come.
Yeah. That's totally true. We're talking to Sophie B. Hawkins right now. So let's go back in the day. Tongues and Tales came out in 92. It got you a Grammy nomination, Best New Artist in 93. And then, of course, the hit that put you on the map the first time was Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover. So how'd you come up with that song? Tell us about, you know, what do you remember about writing it? Where were you at? Kind of like, you know.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I was in my apartment in New York. I can remember the day and the feeling right now. I can remember the light coming through my window. I have the piano still. I wrote it on this cheap upright. I remember the moment that the song came out when I was doing the verse and the chorus. And the first thing that happened was those verse chords are so cool. You know, it's the A major to D over a G, which makes it very unusual. And I said, this is really cool. And it started bringing out the feelings that I was obviously feeling, Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover, about someone. So the song started coming out. And then I got to the chorus, and then it started making its way in, you know, sort of manifesting, I guess, is what happens. I mean, you know, we all have feelings, and I think why that relates to so many people is there's a lot of people who have felt like that song. And then it started coming, and I tell you, I knew when I recorded that again on a reel-to-reel tape, I thought, this is the best song I've ever written. This is going to put me on the map. I absolutely knew that. But guess what? It was like 2 years until someone ever recognized it. In fact, people didn't like it at first.
Huh. How did you come up with the line, this monkey can't stand to see you black and blue? That's my favorite of that. That's awesome.
Oh, my God. It's so much my life. And I think that it might be your favorite because you relate to it like this monkey, you know. It's like that's, I guess, how I see myself so much. You know, if you put an obstacle, I'll just climb over it. Or, you know, the city is my jungle. However you want to see the monkey analogy. I felt like I'm a monkey. My kid's a monkey, my son Dashiell. And then I guess as a child, I must have seen myself as a monkey in a tree and seeing the person that I love most around me beaten up, not only by the world, but by himself. And there's also an inside joke about Johnny Walker, black and blue. So there's a lot of, I guess, many images in there. But I think a lot of times, David, when you think of songs that are really emotional, you have to take them back that the writer's an adult, perhaps, but they're really writing from a kid's standpoint.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. That does make sense. And then, so, about that same time, and, you know, Bob Fest, 1992, Madison Square Garden, Bob Dylan honored him. What was it like performing there? That had to have been pretty sweet.
That was amazing. You know, Sheryl Crow was the background singer.
Oh, really?
Isn't that weird? That's the first time I met her. And you know, she wasn't Sheryl Crow then. She was just a background singer, but I'll never forget her smile.
She was a teacher back then, right?
She was a what?
A teacher, you know, back in the day, back in her day.
She probably was. I don't know anything. I don't know much about her, but I knew that. I know her music. But I just remember her smile, and I remember her being specifically nice to me. Like, I think that she must have recognized the kindred spirit or whatever, and I remember her sort of standing out in the whole group. They were famous background singers, really famous musicians. You know, it was Booker T and the MGs. And she was one of the background singers, and I just remember her smile. Other than that, I remember, you know, obviously meeting Bob Dylan and Chrissy Hynde and all those people, Roseanne Cash, all those people. And but when I walked out on that stage, I was just awestruck. Because, you know, I always had this, like, defense, like, I'm a real New Yorker, and this is my city. And so Madison Square Garden was in my city, right? And Bob Dylan was my artist. I grew up with him. I loved him. So up until that moment I walked on stage, I was a little bit like, this is mine. You know, I'm here for Bob Dylan, but this is my version of the song in my city. And then I walked on the stage and realized none of that was true. This was a huge concert for something so much bigger than me, and I was just dumbstruck at the magnitude of Bob Dylan's work. And, you know, like, something very private became very public. You know, I don't know if you've ever had that feeling when you're a kid again and you love an artist. It's like they're your artist. You don't share them necessarily. No one knows them like you know them and whatever. And so that's how that moment affected me. I was just dumbstruck that suddenly this wasn't just my artist anymore. This wasn't just my version. This wasn't just my Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, that's kind of surreal, I'm sure.
It was very surreal. And I was the smallest, less known artist there. I was like, I was nothing. I was a roach, basically.
That's funny. So you're second. That got a roach. You're killing me here. Okay, the second album was Wailer, 1994. Two songs I want to talk about. Others, all of them are great, obviously, but the radio ones. Right Beside You, As I Lay Me Down. So first of all, Right Beside You is my favorite song that you've done. Kind of tell us, you know.
Oh, wow. That's really deep. That's the second time this week I've heard that.
Really? That's a good song.
Yeah, from a radio guy. I think that song must have struck people. That's really interesting. There's a haunting quality to it for me.
Huh. So, you know, how'd you come up with that one? Is it, you know, real personal, I'm sure?
Yeah, they're all really personal. I wish that I had, like, a funny story that I bumped into some famous person, but none of them are like that. It's just, it's a, obviously a very personal, that came out. That story came out that from a love that wouldn't, somebody that just kept rejecting me, but I held on to this incredible love, and that's what that song's about, basically. Like, I have this amazing, I went through years and years of being totally tortured by someone, and that song is coming out of that relationship, and that someone who just kept coming and going and going and going, and then coming a little bit, then going. So I had that more. You know, when you're young and you can hold on forever, and probably I'm going to be like that with my kid. No matter what he goes through, I'm just always going to be here. And I think Right Beside You is one of those songs.
And then
you're always going to be there for someone.
As I Lay Me Down, how about that one?
Oh, my God. Well, that one is very autobiographical. You know, I talk about the train, the whistle of the train in the summer evening. That's really about my father coming in from New York when we went to Sag Harbor in the summer. We put the pennies on the track, and that emotional love for my father, that's what that song's about. He didn't, like, I didn't sit there and say, I'm writing a song about Daddy, but when I started writing the song triggered by someone else, those images came from my childhood.
And 1998, I know Gigi helped a document about your life came out, The Cream Will Rise. First of all, is that available? I've never actually seen that. Can I see that? And what's it about exactly?
Yes, if we can remember after this call, because our lives get so crazy, but we should send it to you. Yeah, it's available, The Cream Will Rise. Well, definitely on my website, sophiebhawkins.com.
Okay.
That's, you know, that's a great movie, and I will say this because it's not necessarily about me. I am used as a tool in it, but you know that this movie is used in centers for abused children. It's used all over the world to help children.
I didn't know that.
I get letters all the time from counselors and teachers and psychologists saying, I showed this to my clients. And there's something about the movie that Gigi filmed it right at a point in my life where I was in so much denial of certain things, but also really wanting to be opened up. So she does the whole journey, and she meets my mother, and she traces back a lot, but it's like watching the journey that a lot of people can relate to. And I think, you know, you're talking about these songs. It's the same thing. They are so personal, but for somehow, the more personal you make things, the more people can relate to them.
Yeah, that's good. That's the name of the game.
Yes, you're right.
So the third album, I don't want to bring up any bad memories. You don't have to expand on this much.
No, there's no bad memories. Don't worry.
Okay, well, so it was delayed by Columbia then while they tried to make you change some things. Supposedly the banjo song. I don't know. That's just what I've read. So
yes, they did. They did. And that, you know, and that's interesting because at the time it was like the big fight of my life, you know, that I was going to keep the banjo on Lose Your Way because I wrote it on the banjo. And also they wanted me to start writing with writing partners who were not even known writers, you know. Because basically what happened was the world changed, right? At that point, what you're saying is that, you know, Columbia became Sony. So everything in our whole world, not just the music business, became intensely corporate. I know it was happening for a while, but that was when it was so obvious to everyone that now we were all beholden to stockholders. Nothing was personal anymore. The singer-songwriter was out. Sony literally told me in many meetings, because they had a lot of respect for me in the beginning. They said, Sophie, the singer-songwriter is no more. It's dead. Now you have to write with producers and write with remixers and write with other writers that we all know that we can have a hit. And I said, but you know you can have a hit with me. You've had so many hits before. And they said, no, we don't. The world's changed. You're old-fashioned. They said, and I was still pretty young. So basically I fought them and I said, and this was like a non-winning fight, and I knew it. To be honest, David, I knew it. But I still had to fight the fight because it's like if you told – and I'm not Van Gogh's level of artistry, but I want to be, okay? But if you told Van Gogh, now you have to paint with people. Because no one, he would say, well, I'd rather be unknown, which of course he was. I'd rather be unknown and be a great painter than have to paint with people who aren't up to what I want to do. They may be good at commercialism, but they're not doing what I want to do. They're not Joni Mitchell, you know? See, the thing is, David, I wanted to go to bed at night and wake up as that I wanted to be my version of what Joni Mitchell got to be. You know, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young or David Bowie. Or Bob Dylan. I wanted to become a great songwriter, and I knew that if I sold out, I wouldn't ever get to be because I'd say, well, you know, there's some things, David, that you can't do in life. If you want to have it, it's like if you want to have a great marriage, you can't have affairs. I'm sorry. And it's unfortunate, but you can't.
No.
You know what I mean? And the thing is, if you do, then you have to go through all this crap and your marriage will never be the same. So if you're going to have a marriage with affairs, you have to say, well, are we going to agree to do this? Or you have to tell the truth and say, I'm about to have an affair. I'm sorry, I'm leaving you. Or you have to lie and go through all that. Well, marriage is easier to me than even being an artist because as an artist, you're not even dealing with someone else. You have to say, Sophie, you have to ask yourself, am I going to become a not real artist, a fake artist who everyone still calls an artist, or am I going to be a real artist? Because that's all I ever wanted to be. You know, it's like somebody who says, all I ever wanted to do was fix Maseratis, and they're not making Maseratis anymore. What are you going to do?
Well, that's true.
You get it?
It's scary.
Yeah, so you got to do it, and you've just got to do it, even if you end up alone on a rock and nobody cares about you. But David, you're still talking to me, so that makes me know that I made the right decision.
Absolutely. And so then I assume that you had to have a giant weight come off of you. So you founded your own label, Trumpet Swan Productions, first independent album, 2004, yeah. Wilderness. I mean, what was that like? Was it just like night and day? Did you feel free again?
Well, you know what? This is interesting. No, and I didn't. And I would never recommend anyone do it except that you kind of have to do it if you have to do it. Because I didn't realize... for a moment, I felt triumphant when I said, when Sony gave me back the masters and they said, okay, just walk away. And I was like, wow. Well, then I didn't realize how hard it was to promote yourself as an artist. I didn't have any idea what was waiting for me. But I chose it. So it's like I say in Only Love, I made my bed. I had to lie in it. So I did. And I did for Wilderness, and it was fun to make it. It was great fun. But then, you know, the promoting almost killed everyone around me. Not like that we were upset. We were all excited. We felt heroic. We were going out and doing what we felt was the new way, but we didn't realize. And you know what else, David? The world was still in that transition, too. Radio was alive, but it was kind of very much changing.
Oh, yeah.
You know? So, you know this, and you could tell your own biography about all this, and I don't have even the inside knowledge that you do, but I did feel it from the artist's point of view. So anyways, no, it wasn't, it was like, whoa, for years and years. And then my manager said, you can't do this to me anymore. You owe me a facelift. So I realized, that's when I realized by this time, after the Bad Kitty Boy mix, I had to get a label. I had to get some kind of support. And actually, by the way, that's why I started doing the musical. I wouldn't have done it if I hadn't. I was really at my wit's end, like I have to do something else with my artistry. And then that opportunity came, and I was grateful it did. But now here comes my album again, so that's exciting.
Yeah, well, and you talk about artistry. I want to talk about your actual artwork. So SophieBHawkins.com has a whole bunch of your artwork on it. So I've got a couple favorites in particular. Do you ever sell that stuff, by the way, on there?
I've sold like maybe like 10 G-Clays. I've never sold a painting because I personally don't think they're good enough yet.
Oh, I do. The Venice one and
I love that one.
Yeah, and then there's the House on the Water. I think it's Sunset or Sunrise. The House on the Water. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, that's in Provincetown. Why are you on the East Coast?
I'm in the middle of the country. I'm in Kansas City, but.
Oh, that's cool.
I just got my first house, so we're gonna have to talk. I'm gonna have to do some negotiating with you.
Oh, that's so sweet. I've never even thought of selling them, but I have to say they're all right here, hanging in my studio, or just leaning against the wall, and I really do. I love painting so much, you have no idea.
Yeah, what do you want to do with that? Where do you see that going? Is it just a hobby or an outlet?
No, I mean, here's what it is. Whenever I do it, I get so into it. And sometimes, like, someone will say to me, why don't you go do a painting? And I go, well, because then the whole world disappears. So while I'm going to put a record out right now, I probably won't get a moment until after the first tour. Because when I start painting, it's like I'm lost. Even more than writing songs, I just go into another world, and I'm so happy and so peaceful. And even though I go through moments of hating the painting, whatever, I will do what I feel it takes to get to the painting, to get to where I feel the painting is the best it can be. So, no, I think I treat it more like an artist, I think. I struggle with it, and I really work on them. Sometimes I'll have a painting that is so terrible, and then I'll pick it up months later, and I'll go back to the site, and I'll work on it until it becomes something beautiful. I'm really intense about it. I don't ever treat it lightly. So what I think, David, is that someday when I've made my mark in music or something, I will go off and paint for a year. So that's my dream. Painting, like, my dream is to be an old woman painter.
With cats, hopefully?
No, with my son all, you know, successful, coming to visit me and...
Okay.
Like, not disappearing, but just like, you know, no face work, just like really being able to paint and write songs only because I really want to, and not, you know, my dream is to like somehow make it in the music business and then be able to become a painter.
You already did make it in the music business, though.
So. I know, but I don't see it that way. I see it that there's like, there's going to be this point where I really... But I probably, maybe I won't, but I kind of see it, maybe I'll feel like I did.
Well, I can't wait to hear this new record. It comes out, like we said, in October. Tell us about it one more time. Kind of, you know, give us the scoop on it. Pimp it out.
Okay, this record is coming out on October 11th, and it has got 17 songs, maybe more by the time it comes out. And I think the people who love my music or like it will go, whoa. This completes the picture of Sophie B. I really do feel that.
Hmm.
And they'll say, some of these songs sound like she could have written them 20 years ago because they're so, like I said, I restarted myself. Like I went way back to the beginning. And some of them sound very new, like they've never heard before. But some of them, they'll go, oh my God, this totally fits in with what I wanted to hear next. And some of them will go, oh, my God, I can't believe she went there. That's crazy. And then I think some will feel like home. I mean, there's certain songs like Georgia where people go, that just makes me so happy. And I understand why it does, because it makes me happy. So it's going to be a really great collection for people who love my music. And I think for people who have never heard my music, you know what I think is going to happen? I think people are going to go, she's such a songwriter. She's such a musician. And that's going to make me very happy, because I think that one of my struggles with Sony was that people never really even knew that I was the writer of the songs, you know?
Yeah. Well, that makes sense.
And that's okay, but I think that this will definitely, I don't know how to say it, but it's perfect. It's like when you meet someone at a certain point, at a different point, you go, you know, I didn't get you before. and I get you now. That kind of thing. I kind of liked you. I thought you were weird, but now I really get you.
Yeah. Well, we can't wait to hear this. And how? So SophieBHawkins.com is a website. You know, Facebook, Twitter. How else can we keep in touch with you and follow you?
Yeah, Facebook is really good. I mean, somebody has to help me with that because I still don't understand Facebook. So I answer messages, and I do post things, but I really don't understand how you guys do it so much and so easily. Twitter, I do understand.
Really?
And all those
more complicated,
yeah.
I think.
Is it?
I think it is.
Oh, my God. Well, I'm more used to Twitter, and I'm telling you, if you would follow me at The Real Sophie B,
yeah.
I am The Real Sophie B, I Twitter back. I really love Twitter because I feel like I get people's personality, and I just really like it. It's very personal. I laugh. I don't do it a lot, but when I get on there and somebody does an at mention, I go, oh, my God, this is so funny. People are funny on Twitter, and they say the funniest things to me. And then I get to respond, and then I get to really, I don't like talking to people. It's amazing to me. With Facebook, I still don't understand because there's so many people on.
That's hilarious. That just seems opposite of what it should be. But
I know, but like a Twitter, I'm responding to someone's Twitter, right? A tweet. But Facebook, there's so many people come up at once, it boggles my mind. I go, I can't even handle this. But I'm sure I'll get used to it. I just need to sit with somebody who's really good at it, you know, like one session at an airport or something, and then I'll get it.
Hey, it's been a true pleasure talking to you. I'm excited for the new album. I'm excited. I'm serious about that artwork, man. If you ever decide to sell any of it, I'll buy some from you. I want a painting for my house.
Awesome. You're so awesome. I will. I would have never know. Let me just do one art show, and then I'll sell you something. Maybe I'll even give it to you because I'm not sure. You know, like, you have to be an established paint. Whatever. I mean, people are so funny. I just want to paint, so we'll see what happens with that.
Established. You need to give yourself more credit. You're established.
You're so funny. Maybe I am. Maybe it's good that I don't think so. Anyway, Dave, I really love this talk.
Yeah, I do, too. And definitely stay in touch. I'm excited for the new album and the next chapter of your life and career. And we're excited to see you around the country. And where I'm based here in Kansas City, can't wait to bring you here.
Me too. Thank you so much.
Take care and have a great day.
Thanks, Dave.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.